a lot more protons and neutrons in the nucleus, but the outer diameter of the atom gets a little bit bigger, but not that much bigger. So the order of magnitude of the mathematics works the same. And here's the way I look at it. A helium atom, the outer cloud of its electrons is approximately 1 angstrom in diameter. That's part of how they decided on the unit angstrom, that a good yardstick for an atom is a helium atom, and a helium atom is roughly 1 angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meters. If I blew up a helium atom and made it as big as the Wembley Stadium in London, the football stadium, which has a 1,000-foot diameter of that stadium, if I blew up the helium atom to be as big as Wembley Stadium, I've now taken this atom that is a 10 to the minus 10 meters in diameter, and I've made it 1,000 feet in diameter, just to scale it so I can see what's going on. The nucleus of that atom is very close to 10 to the 5 smaller, one with five zeros after it, 100,000 times smaller. So in Wembley Stadium, you've got this helium atom, it's 1,000 feet in diameter. The nucleus of that helium atom is a tenth of an inch in diameter, which is 3 millimeters. 3 millimeters, or a tenth of an inch diameter, in the middle of Wembley Stadium is the nucleus. Let's assume now that I want to do a nuclear reaction on that helium atom. I've got this real high-power rifle that can issue bullets at nearly the speed of light. And my bullets are a tenth of an inch in diameter, the same diameter as the nucleus. So I've got bullets that are a tenth of an inch in diameter coming out of my rifle, and my rifle shoots them at close to the speed of light, and now I want to hit that nucleus in the middle of Wembley Stadium. And I'm doing it from my helicopter that's a mile above the stadium. Think about the degree of accuracy required. I'm a mile above the stadium, shooting down on the stadium. The target is a tenth of an inch in diameter. I'm
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The target is a tenth of an inch in diameter. I'm using bullets that are a tenth of an inch in diameter, and I want my bullet at the speed of light coming out of my high-power rifle, my super high-power rifle. I wanted to hit that nucleus in the middle of Wembley Stadium so that I can create a nuclear reaction. Can you get a vague idea of trying to hit a target a tenth of an inch in diameter from a mile away? You get a real rapid feeling of how difficult that is. Okay, I'm going to use the blunderbuss technique. I'm going to use a shotgun technique. I'm going to stand up there with my helicopter, shooting down at Wembley Stadium, and I'm going to shoot 1 billion bullets. And I've got enough accuracy of my gun that I guarantee that every one of the bullets hits somewhere in Wembley Stadium. So I'm using 1 billion bullets hitting Wembley Stadium, and I'm trying to hit this target that's a tenth of an inch in diameter. Assuming I've got a uniform distribution of the bullets, that every one of them falls somewhere in Wembley Stadium, and I've got a uniform distribution of them, because the ratio of the area of that nucleus compared to the area of that atom, 1,000-foot diameter, tenth of an inch in diameter, and you've got to take that diameter and square it in order to figure out the area. There is 10 to the 10 ratio of area of atom to area of nucleus. 10 billion to 1 is the ratio. So I've got a uniform distribution of the bullets from my helicopter down on the stadium, and I've shot 1 billion bullets. But the ratio of the areas of the nucleus to the hold-on atom is 10 billion to 1. The bottom line of that is I shoot a billion bullets, and I've only got one chance in 10 of hitting the target. A billion bullets from a mile away, uniform distributed, every one of them falling into the stadium.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Only one chance in 10 of a billion shots am I going to hit the target. That's the beginning of a nuclear reaction. Now when I hit the target, I want to hit it straight on. If I hit it a little bit off to one side, I'm going to get a billion shot, and it's going to glance off, and nothing's going to happen. You see the accuracy required. The reason why you need a critical mass is that if each one of those atomic reactions where a particle spontaneously came out of a nuclear atom, and if it's very similar to what is it now called, Alber's paradox, if you had enough stars in the universe scattered across the universe, the whole universe would be white. Well, if I shoot a particular bullet from atom number one into this cloud of nuclear particles, of uranium particles, and if the uranium particles goes far enough, and that particle went in one particular direction, eventually it's going to hit something. So by the law of averages, if I've got enough material, my particular particle eventually is going to go far enough and hit a nucleus. So my understanding of what constitutes a critical mass is that now, by the probability of shooting a billion particles, so to speak, a billion gunshots, and one chance in 10 am I going to hit out of a billion, but if I got more than a billion targets out there because I got enough material altogether, I'm going to hit something. And now I stand the chance of the reaction getting above unity in input versus output, and therefore sustaining what you and I call a chain reaction. That's my understanding of why a critical mass is required to get a nuclear reaction. Anybody want to have any questions or comments on this one? K2RIW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, the trick is to get that mass, and my understanding of the hydrogen bomb, they needed to actually surround it with a fission, you know, atom bomb, in other words, the earlier ones, and the blast of that would compress the plutonium on the inside, so this way they wound up with a hydrogen bomb effect by actually, you know, using, it was like really two bombs at once. That's what I remember reading about that. I don't know how true that is, but that's how you got the compression. I guess they're bringing that helicopter down to a lower level near the, you know, to change the distance, and that probably increased their ability to have these things hit one another. That's what I was thinking.
That's a fairly good analogy, Paul. So whatever your reacting material is, if I can create a situation where the individual atoms have been compressed, moving them close enough together, what you're saying is equivalent to bringing the helicopter down to a lower altitude. That's one way of looking at it. Or I've now packed a hell of a lot more, in my case, helium atoms. I've taken the helium atoms that used to be 1,000 foot in diameter, and I managed to compress them so that they now are forced into a smaller area, volume, and I've got more of them in the stadium. So if I can put enough of them in the stadium because I've compressed them, then the chances of my gun hitting the target drastically increases. So many of the fission bombs and fusion bombs require compression. I think the most popular fission bomb these days, you've got a whole lot of chunks of the equivalent of dynamite all around the sphere, and if you can very accurately set off every one of them at the right instant of time, the blast that creates will compress the material. It's kind of hard to believe. I mean, if you and I took a chunk of steel and we hit it with a hammer, the chances of us taking the chunk of steel from 1 cubic inch and bringing it under the heat of the under the compression of the hammer to bring it down to a half an inch, so to speak, a half a cubic inch, you and I can't do that with a hammer. But if you've got a big enough blast, you can. What you think is a solid material can be compressed to a very small size if you can create enough force to do that. And so this implosion effect, whether you're doing it with the whether you're doing it with a less than critical mass of uranium with a whole bunch of, let me call it, pyrotechnic devices on the outside, that when they all set off simultaneously, it compresses it down to a smaller diameter, smaller volume, therefore it becomes a critical mass when it wasn't a critical mass before. You're doing that with a typical fission bomb, to my knowledge, and now if your hydrogen reacting material is in the middle of that, and it's experiencing the compression wave created by the fission bomb going off, and now compressing that material, it now becomes a critical mass, and you're now using the so-called hydrogen material for which I think is deuterium or tritium, which if you have enough of it, that gives you a pretty potent bomb. So you're starting to get close to the point where you're converting E equals mc squared. A very small amount of mass gives you a huge amount of energy. So having enough material there, or squeezing the ordinary amount of material to a small enough volume, allows your rifle to become more accurate, and now your natural decay particles coming off at the speed of light are going to hit another target and therefore sustain the chain reaction. Does that sort of make it a little bit more clear? And this is a bunch of guesses on my part, but maybe we're going to confirm it. WS2N, K2RIW.
Comment. Sounds very good to me. John, over to you.
Okay, Dick, don't forget, when little man, little boy, was the first one we used on a target, that was uranium bomb. Now, don't forget, all you had was two mass objects in there. The critical mass came when they just put them together, and that was with a cannon shot. So the activity of the neutrons in those two individual mass were not enough to sustain your reaction. But as soon as they met, all they had to do was come together. That's when you started the chain reaction.
You're absolutely right, but there's one more ingredient here. You've got to overcome the Leidenfrost effect. Leidenfrost effect means that many reactions become self-limiting. If I take a pot of water and I put a flame underneath it to boil the pot of water, you get some gentle boiling. You would think, therefore, that if I've got a griddle that's at not 212 degrees Fahrenheit, but I've got it at 500 degrees Fahrenheit, and I pour some water in that griddle, you would assume the water is going to evaporate instantaneously. It doesn't. You take droplets of water on your hot griddle, and you watch those droplets of water dance all over the place. What's happening is that the bottom of the droplet of water touching the griddle creates a layer of steam. The layer of steam suspends the rest of that particle of water above the griddle, and it doesn't get a chance to touch the griddle right away. So in other words, that's called the Leidenfrost effect. That particular reaction becomes self-limiting. Those droplets of water last a hell of a lot longer on your hot griddle than you think they're going to. Let me drop. By the same token, if that was little boy that consisted of these two masses of uranium, and you're going to bring them together, common sense would lead you to believe at first that you could just bring them together with a spring. Uh-oh. You better bring them together with an extremely violent force, like some dynamite or whatever, a real high-power rifle shot, because at the instant those two chunks start coming together, the reaction they create is going to create a local heating that's going to spread them apart, and you're not going to get very much yield out of it. So you got to bring them together with a tremendous amount of force and hold them there for the right number of microseconds in order to get all of the material reacting. I am guessing that that barrel-like structure that brought those two masses together and the size of the explosive force doing it, I'll bet you it was quite significant. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW?
And one other comment, the WS1.
2WGB. Well, Dick, they used an altered artillery shell type to do that, and they just shot one part of the critical mass into the other. And you're right, it was a big explosive charge. But you brought up a very interesting point. There was a demonstration on TV, and God, if anybody's listening, don't try it, but it works. I don't know if you saw it, Dick, but the man put his hand directly into a pot of boiling lead. Did you happen to see that? And I'll tell you how he did it.
I'm going to guess his hand was very moist ahead of time. I'm guessing he put it into the boiling lead very briefly. A little bit similar to what happens with a firewalker. If their feet are sweaty enough, if they walk briefly enough across the fire, they might not get too badly burned. Back to you, John.
Right on target, Dick. That's exactly what he did. He dipped his hand in water. Then he shook all the water off. It was just a minute layer on there. and he stuck his hand in. And I don't think it was Mythbusters, but it was something like that. Now, his explanation was, and the professor who was there is, the water takes so long to absorb the heat, it really is a latency of a long time. That's what protected his skin, and he did it several times. Yes, it was quick, but you actually, it wasn't any camera tricks. You could see he put his hand in at a moderate rate and took it out. Didn't even get warm. It was incredible. I wouldn't try it, but I saw it done.
Bullshit. Is there some chance that that was real? Particularly if the guy soaked his hand in the water for a long enough period of time. You know, if you soak your hand in water for a long period of time, you'll watch the skin start getting wrinkly. There's quite a bit of water absorption in that skin. And so for a very brief period of time, I presume he put his hand in the lid for maybe less than 1 second. And so the boiling of the water on the surface of his skin, pushing the lead away, means that the lead was not really touching his skin. There was a layer of steam in between the two. The thing he's got to worry about was when he retracts his hand from the lead, you have to make sure that some droplet doesn't somehow stick to the hand, that it all falls away. I'm guessing his hand was in the lead for less than 1 second. Is that true, John?
Yes, Dick, that's approximately, it was like down and up. Yeah, I would say maybe a second, second and a half. Interesting experiment, and no, this was real. They had enough people there, and he did it several times. Of course, nobody else would try it, and you could actually see this lead. You saw them melt the lead down and everything. It was just amazing. And there's another reason that people aren't aware of. Why does steam burn worse than boiling water? They're both 212 degrees. Well, the fact is, the heat has to be given up for the steam to condense back to water, and that water is still at 212 degrees, so it continues to burn, and it burns much worse than boiling water. So a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, high-pressure steam can cut like a knife. It's a very dangerous substance, and heat of vaporization is a huge amount of heat. When you convert water from the liquid form to the gaseous form, you have to put 540 calories into each gram of water. That's a lot. And that huge conversion efficiency, huge conversion characteristic, is what powers a hurricane. The hurricane has got a low pressure center, which is sucking in air from the outside, moist ocean moist air, which is a highly vaporized air. As that column of air goes into the center and rises to a higher altitude where the temperature is colder, the moist air is being converted back into water. You and I call that rain. 540 calories, which is a huge amount. Therefore, you've got this very hot chimney in the center. That's creating the low pressure in the center of the hurricane, which continues to suck in moist air from the outside. So the amount of energy during a hurricane is close to an atomic bomb going off once every single second, and that goes on for a week. Tremendous amount of energy. Where is it coming from? Rain. All of that conversion of water vapor into liquid water, rain. I know that you want to say something, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm going back to the atomic bomb efficiency. I had read years ago it was 4%. The first bombs that went off, the rest of it, you know, it didn't, 96% of it didn't react. So, you know, it separates so fast that, you know, only 4% of it really reacted. And I'm on your heat topic. You can tell the difference between the mechanics and the engineer type. You're dealing in calories. We were taught in BTUs, 940 BTUs per pound of water, Dick. For latent heat evaporation or condensation, and it was 144 for freezing going to ice. And it, and John's right. If you go from, let's say, for Fahrenheit 32 up to 212, that's 180 BTU per pound of water change. So you know that right before it changes to steam, and now you know, that process of going to steam, it's another 940, you know, call it 940 BTU compared to that 180 that was in the first. There's a little bit of water that's sitting there. That's a big difference. You get burned by that, you're in big trouble. I've gotten a lot of steam burns. Back to you, Dick.
Enter exchange. Looks like you forgot about me.
John, Paul, you just said something really magic, and that is 4% efficiency. And I think the 4% is because you're not able to hold the materials into that reactive environment for a long enough period of time. At the center of that environment, you're getting this huge nuclear reaction. Again, it's a kind of a Leyden force effect, which is spreading the material, slowing down the reaction. I am guessing the higher yield bombs are the ones where you have some kind of a focusing device on the outside, keeping the materials together for a longer period of time. That's my guess as to what's going on. Have you heard anything along those lines, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
And I've seen them built like a cone effect, you know. The cone is jammed into, compressed into the other piece. And you have two bombs on one side, two detonators like TNT to do it. And when you get into the hydrogen, then, you're actually surrounding it with a fission bomb. I don't know what they have today, but, the efficiency, I'm sure, has gone way up. But, compared to the original. But the originals were 4%. So, big difference. It blows off and then, it's like separating the molecules. They don't hit one another. It's not like matter and antimatter. You put those two together and you got up 100% efficiency. That would be wonderful. Back to there.
Now, part of the reason why we're discussing this right now is because a discussion that John, I, Wesley, and a few others had earlier in the week was that there have been a couple of people who have filed patents for what they believe was an apparatus that was creating a nuclear reaction. They were starting off with certain materials that had nuclear reaction capability or radioactive materials, and by putting the materials together in a vial and heating the vial with, let's call it microwave oven type heating characteristic, they assume that the heating would create the nuclear reaction. And I'm expressing a lot of skepticism of that. I'm not sure that you can make that work, because even if I've got nuclear materials, the fact that I've heated the materials, I've made them go to a higher temperature. Let me drop. What your thermometer measures is the average kinetic energy of the molecules. By kinetic energy, I mean mechanical kinetic energy. The individual atoms or molecules are moving at a faster rate. The air molecules in that room with you right now, on average, all of those air molecules are moving at the speed of 500 meters per second at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. You calculate that as an absolute temperature in degrees Kelvin, and double that temperature, then they're going to be moving square root of 2 faster. The average speed of the molecules are what you and I call temperature. That's what your thermometer measures. So the fact that I take molecules of a nuclear material and I move them a little bit faster because I've raised their temperature. I said a little bit faster because to get a nuclear reaction, in order for your particle to penetrate that outer hard shell of a atom or molecule, the hard shell I'm talking about is the iron curtain, I'm calling it, of the outer cloud of electrons. To penetrate that cloud of electrons, take something at close to the speed of light in velocity, to have the right accuracy to hit that tiny little nucleus in the center with enough velocity and enough accuracy to break up that nucleus to do your nuclear reaction, to violate the strong force that's trying to hold that all together. It requires a lot of physics to do that. Just raising the temperature is not going to do it. To take your particular raw materials, let's assume you've got some of A, B, C, and D materials, atoms, and some of them are radioactive and some of them are not, and you're going to heat them up and make a brand new compound. Compound really means that the outer valence electrons are such that these two hydrogens want to be alongside of that particular oxygen molecule. You've combined the two, and so the two hydrogens and the oxygen have now made a water molecule. You've made a combination of the outer electrons. You haven't done anything to the nucleus. No matter how you made that water molecule, you haven't disturbed the nucleus. A tiny little knot called the nucleus in the center, you haven't touched him. So changing a compound, doing a chemical reaction, and heating things up, that by itself, in the normal manner, in my belief, cannot give you a nuclear reaction if you didn't have a nuclear reaction to begin with. So that particular patent that Wes brought to our attention, I'm not sure it ever got granted. It was a patent application, and whether or not anyone ever built that apparatus that was supposedly giving a large amount of energy output for very little energy input, because it was taking radioactive materials and suddenly making them more reactive by this apparatus, I'm having a lot of trouble with that. I'm very skeptical, as you can tell. Now you know why I'm skeptical, and therefore you guys can shoot holes in my theories. Over to you, Wes, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, N2CN. What's the microphone for me?
We're hearing you loud and clear, Wes.
Okay, use the WSTN. Okay, there was another patent. I didn't include that check patent exactly from very much similar time of it. And was very much similar matter. What we're dealing with is the electromagnetic field excitation. I was trying to compare that from that's what I mentioned a few times already, Ford Mammoth from 1989, which was transmutation of the material, which is the affecting of nuclear structure by using a frequency, nothing else but frequency. So we're talking about the chemical reaction, which does not really require a lot of power to change the structure of the molecular composition, or we're talking about just the frequency that is affecting the same, which I repeat again, at frequency 555 megahertz, zinc is replaced with manganium is replacing zinc. The other frequency, I don't recall which one, then we're talking about interaction between zinc and ferrum, which is the part that is iron, okay, and it changes it forever. Whether this works or it doesn't work, it's kind of a question whether the reactor that was sent on Mars works or is not working. I mean, do you know the nature of this reactor and how this reactor is working? And to engineer.
If I take potentially radioactive materials, or really radioactive materials, and I expose them to any frequency you want to, it is my belief that no matter what frequency you use, a microwave oven type thing, so to speak, that doesn't affect the nucleus. It affects the outer shell of the molecules or atoms. I can heat up them with I can heat them up with microwave energy.
How about nuclear magnetic resonance?
Nuclear magnetic resonance is a precession effect. It's not really getting you nuclear energy. They call it nuclear magnetic resonance. It's a precession effect where in the case of a very strong magnetic field, you have dictated the precession rate of the way the molecules move as far as their axis of rotation is concerned.
Well, that's what the Ford Mammoth was doing. That's what John Hodgson was doing. And if not, then explain me how in the world Ford Mammoth was able to produce that paper that I mentioned so many times and make the transportation successful.
Okay. In order to do transmutation, in order to convert a molecule of uranium into a molecule of lead, an atom of uranium into an atom of lead, which is a whole lot of steps in between, but in order to get a brand new element on the periodic table, you have to change the number of protons in that nucleus. That's an extremely difficult to do. Whether I want to increase the number of protons, I want to add some protons, or take some protons out of there. That nucleus is the hardest shelled, tightest packed thing you and I can imagine, held together by the strong nuclear force, and for you to reach in there and yank out a proton, just because you're doing something on the outside with radio energy, magnetic energy, or whatever. If you're not doing it with a particle accelerator, where you're firing bullets in there at the speed of light that penetrates the outer shell and goes into the inner shell, until you do that, these much, much lower energy procedures, if you think they're reaching in there and yanking out protons and causing transmutation and causing element A to become element B, I am very skeptical of that. And it's so difficult with such low energy procedures, I don't think it's really taking place. There may have been a man, let me drop. There may have been a very well-educated man at Fort Monmouth, just like you had two very well-educated people at University of Utah who believed they had discovered cold fusion. These guys had very good track record, had done lots of research in the past, written lots of articles, had a very good reputation, but this particular experiment, they thought it was a nuclear reaction. And we now know 25 years later, the chances are probably 1 in a million that it was a nuclear reaction. Very unlikely.
Well, I have a tool. We have 2 minutes left. I have a tool. One is Department of Chemistry of Ireland, University of Waco, Texas, USA. That's February 28th, year 2000. And we have the mention of about 1988-89, which says the frequency 300 to 470 megahertz, which was identified as manganium, three ions replacing iron, by using frequency. That's what they say. Okay, and talking about the temperature, people were playing with different temperatures, but they were playing also with temperatures 77 to 200 Kelvin as well. So how would you react to that?
Frequency doesn't do it. In the case of nuclear magnetic resonance, you wanted to use that as an example. Are you telling me, Wes, that you believe nuclear magnetic resonance does transmutation, changes the number of protons in that nucleus? Do you think NMR, MRI does that? Over to you, Wes.
Well, we're dealing with the proton. We're basically affecting the structure, the nuclear structure of the metal. And yes, I do believe that.
So you're telling me I can take any substance you name, I can put it into an MRI machine, I turn on the machine, I run it for a while, at the end of running it, I take the material back out of the machine, and it's not the same element anymore, it has been transmuted to some other material. Are you telling me an
Mass, November Alpha Foxtrot. And the call sign is November 2 Uniform Zulu Delta. And to use it at the end, the name is Mass.
Okay, fine. K1UFM. Let me see if I have it. Usually we have a Peter and a Ron on in the morning also. I guess they're just running a little bit early. So you're doing some sort of golf tournament or volunteer work or something, Kevin? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's the Barclays. The Pro Tour is coming into Bethpage for the week. And what I'll be doing is that we have vans strategically placed over the course in case of there's an example lightning, and we have to get the golfers and their caddies off the course. You know, that's part of their part of the protocol that in all these golf tournaments. You never see them, of course, you know, they're off out of camera sight, but there are people waiting to take them off you know, at a moment's notice. So there's I don't know how many vans there are, but it should be okay. I worked the U.S. Open once before, but doing marshalling. That's the people you see on TV that tell people to be quiet, and you can go through the ropes now, and you can't there, blah, blah, blah. But this is, it should be interesting. You know, there's different parts of transportation. Some people, while they're volunteering, they're picking up people at airports and bringing them in and this and that. I think this is pretty cool. I mean, I'm right at the on the course, and hopefully the vans where we put them out on, I guess, Saturday, they sit there until Sunday night, you know, and no one has to use them.
Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, I did stop for a second. I was thinking about something about work. But to answer your question before, yeah, I'm on my way in. I'm in the city already. I'm on my way over to my office in Brooklyn. That's my first stop. And as usual, I'm all over the place during the day today. Kevin, pick it up. I think I'm hopping the rotation here. I'm going to be getting off too because I'm on a couple of traffic circles here getting close to Bethpage. So it was nice. It was short but sweet talking to you guys. So 7-3, hope everybody arrives safely. Have a good day, and just remember, no lightning this weekend. Just everybody think, no lightning this week, this whole week. All right, this is KC2KC, 7-3 to all. Clear.
KC2KC and K1UFM Mobile. Nice meeting you, Kevin. Have a good time out there, and, you know, there's fair skies to everybody. Over to you now.
Yeah, 7-3. Sorry, I forgot your call sign already. You have a great day. And I like that, no lightning. Okay. Very good. Ted, back to you.
Nothing. Well, you have me to thank for the next 2 weeks of cool weather coming up. Our window air conditioner in the bedroom died last week, and if it was another 2 weeks later, I'd wait till next season to buy one. But so I picked one up, put it in the window yesterday, and that, usually I do something like that. It guarantees us at least 2 weeks of cool weather.
Yeah, I've been sleeping with a window fan. Not even really. Well, it's a window fan, but it's not even mounted in the window. And our bedroom AC died. Oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. When it gets really hot, we just sleep in the living room on the couches. My wife and myself. My kids are not used to sleeping with air conditioners, so fans do it for them. We have air conditioners. I didn't bother putting them in this year. But going on, this year would be that hot that they were complaining that I didn't put them in, and I just never got around to it. Well. At least it's winding down out of heat, and the kids were away for a month in camp. during the really hot weather, so we got through it. Now we'll see what happens. Traffic's been pretty good this morning. How about you?
When we went to buy the HU, went to Home Depot, they're out. Went to Walmart, they're out. Went to Costco, they're out. Everybody's out. Go to PC Richards. They had plenty of them, good selection, on sale, discount, and I think I ended up with a 297 Sharp for 199. You know, air conditioning today lasts about 10 years, so it's worth having. And you know, whether you're going to sleep, a good night's sleep is worth that to me. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm with you, but my wife, you know, it's funny, she's not crazy about air conditioning. I mean, even like in the living room, the dining room, it's got to be really hot before she puts it on. Although this year's been an exception. She's, having hot flashes or whatever. she's been hotter than usual, and sometimes I think it's okay. We don't need the air conditioner, and she's the one to put it on. So, I don't know. Never figured them out, that's for sure. boy, back to you. This is N2UZD5D.
N2UZD1UFM. Yeah, our bedroom's on the second floor, and the way our heating system in the house is, it's about 5 or 6 degrees warmer upstairs than downstairs. So if we were sleeping downstairs, we probably could get away with a fan. But, you know, it makes a difference. You close the windows, all that outside noise is gone. And if I get a good night's sleep, it's well worth it. Let's see, and where's the rest of the regulars this morning? Where's our friend Peter and our friend Ron? I wonder what they're up to this morning. Back to you.
I don't know where they are. But, our bedrooms are on the second floor, too, and most of the time, some good fans seem to do it. Occasionally when it's really hot, I do like my wife does. I sleep in the living room. We had one day, we had a few days, where the kids just stretched out on the floor in the living room. We all slept in the living room. My wife grabbed one couch, I grabbed the other, the kids on the floor in sleeping bags, or on top of sleeping bags, I should say, and we did okay, but the next year I'm going to make sure to do the air conditioners properly. My wife complains that she likes fresh air and blah, 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 meanwhile she barely slept in the bedroom all summer long, so next year I'm just going to do what I want to do, which is put the air conditioner in the window. I'll get a new one for our bedroom, and I'll put the one for the kids in, and that'll be that. This summer's almost over, hopefully. So back to you.
Z2KKX.
2KKX, recognized K1UFM. Well, fortunately, over the years, they've gotten lighter and wetter. They used to have a couple of big Henry Friedrichs, which were almost a two-man operation to put in and out of the windows. But these newer, cheaper ones made in China, they're still substantially strong. They're made out of steel, but they're a lot lighter in weight. It's a very easy one-man job. Over to you, Peter, K1UFM.
Good morning. I'd say it's an odd morning to be talking about AC. For once, it's almost pleasant.
Yeah, well, I don't remember how we got into the conversation on AC.
We got into it because my window air conditioner for our bedroom died, and if it was 2 or 3 weeks later, I'd just wait the next season to buy one, but I had to go out and buy one this weekend. And Costco was out, Home Depot was out, Walmart was out. Fortunately, PC Richards had plenty of them on sale, so Usually when I do something like that, it guarantees us at least 2 weeks of cool weather. Peter?
Well, I was going to say thank you, Ted. And at least you got it at the end of the season. So I imagine you got a pretty good price. Nav?
You know, that's a good idea. I should go check out PP Richard and see. Maybe I'll pick up a new AC for next year. So I'll have it ready. Get it while it's on sale. The only thing is that I just wonder how long the warranties are on these things. Because sometimes, you know, I don't know, I want to take a chance on losing the warranties next year. We'll have to check it out. Ted?
I earned a lot of PC Richards up in Connecticut, but I bought a couple TVs there a few years ago, and it was nice. You walk in there, the guy jumps right on you, shows you the selection. And we bought a name brand, Sharp, instead of an off-brand. I think it was $297 on sale for $231. Then you sign up for a PC Richards card, it was $199. And the guy carries out the car and puts it in the trunk for you. So, you know, it's nice to have that kind of service. I forgot what a nice store PC Richards was. I'm almost at my destination, guys. So I'm going to say 7-3. Have a cool 2 weeks, and you're welcome. K1UFM, over to you, Peter.